Hello. In the previous audio snippet, we spoke about how the new American Constitution will castrate the political party system that is in place currently and prevent it ever rising again and causing what we have mentioned to be the power clots that abound in our political system. And in this audio snippet, we'll just make a few additional final comments, minor comments related to what we spoke about previously. So one side note that I believe is important to mention, even though it was more or less implicit in all that we spoke before, is that the Founding Fathers, in a sense, enabled the current corrupt party system in two ways, in an implicit way. In one way, it was when they introduced the concept of Speaker of the House into the Constitution, they effectively enabled the power of parties to control operations at the legislative level. So if a group of people decided to do things a certain way, they could vote someone into the speakership who could then control what everybody else could do in the legislative branch. And that enabled parties to then start having control and making it important for them to have a majority so that they can then impose rules, arbitrary rules on everybody else. And that's how power clots began to develop. And we've spoken about that before, but it's worth emphasizing. So that very concept of Speaker of the House, is, which is embedded in the Constitution, is a way of introducing the cancer of political party power into the system. And the other way in which the Founding Fathers in a sense, enabled the party system is that they practiced it in real life. As some of you may know, basically at the beginning of the country of the United States, there were two political parties that slowly developed. One was the Federalist Party, and the other one was what I believe was called something like the Democrat Republican Party. And the Federalist Party, contrary to its name, basically was more for a more powerful national government. And the Democrat Republican Party was more for local state power. Usually in these audio snippets, when we use the word federalism, we are talking about the concept of dividing power and centralizing it at the state level and kind of weakening the national government in that sense. But ironically, the Federalists of the at the start of the country were the people who wanted more national government power because they knew that we could not be a real nation if we were divided into these 13 separate entities that did whatever they wanted and could never, did not have a central government that could then organize itself properly so that we could be a functioning nation instead of just this conglomerate of 13 different mini republics, Soviet style, 13 mini republics just trying to pretend to be a nation. So the Federalists wanted a stronger national government. And the Democrat Republicans, who are led by people like Thomas Jefferson, and I believe James Madison was also more of that camp. They wanted more state sovereignty. So they kind of formed into. And by the way, I believe Madison, even though I think he was leaning Democrat-Republican, did have a certain awareness that we did need a stronger national government. So the thing is that you have at the beginning of the country the formation of these two groups, and then the political activity kind of rallied around these two groups, and the founding fathers were there. They saw it happen, and they were okay with it. So we have had this acceptance of the party system from the very beginning of the country, and how the parties, you know, were able to become the focal points of political power. That was enabled by the founding fathers, either implicitly or explicitly, from the very beginning, even though in the Constitution there really is no, as far as I can remember at the moment, any real explicit a reference to a party system, at least, you know, at least in the way that we have it currently. But it was implicitly there all along and accepted and enabled by the founding fathers, and we are to destroy that system that they enabled and just accept it as a way of life. So that's what the new American Constitution will do. It will destroy the system, castrate it permanently through measures such as the ones we described before. So another, a few other things that we'd like to mention, minor things that will contribute to this castration of the political party system. One of those things would be to constitutionally prohibit professional lobbying. As you know, Washington, D.C. here in the U.S. is well known for its lobbying groups. I think there's a reference to a street called K Street, because in Washington, D.C., I haven't been there in decades, literally, but I vaguely remember that streets were, there were a lot of streets that had letter names, like A Street, B Street, or something like that. I could be completely wrong, it was so long ago, but there is a street in Washington, if I'm not mistaken, that is called K Street, and that street is famous for being the lobbying street, where a lot of lobbying groups have their offices and stuff. And it is sad that we have a system where we have these people who are professionally paid to lobby Congress people and political members. So they are living day and night just getting paid to go and persuade these politicians, and so they become professional prostitutes, political prostitutes. So whoever pays them enough will have their services, and they will go and influence voting. And whoever has more money to pay these professional prostitutes to go talk to politicians will have a greater chance of political influence. So the power clots develop again, and we should not have that. Lobbying should not be unconstitutional, per se, because obviously we want the people to have the power to persuade politicians, legislators, to vote in a certain way. So lobbying itself is not wrong. It's just having people who live, who get paid to do it. So all persuasion in the Constitution, all political persuasion should be free and as publicly available as possible. In other words, I shouldn't have to pay to persuade. If I'm persuading, well, I will do it of my own time and effort, and I will do it for free. If I believe in a cause, then I will invest off myself in persuading whoever needs to be persuaded in favor of this cause. And whatever persuasion I carry out should be as publicly available as possible. So if so-and-so was trying to persuade so-and-so to do it, we should hopefully all be able to know about it. So obviously that can't possibly be done at a practical level. For example, if a legislator is walking down the street and someone recognizes him or her, and then let's say it's a he, so this person comes running towards him and tries to talk to him and say, hey, you should vote this way on this upcoming bill and blah, blah, blah. That's an impromptu persuasion happening on the street on any given day. And naturally, we can't just force that to be recorded and then be posted somewhere so that everybody can know that this persuasion attempt happened at this specific point. So obviously not everything can be made public, but the Constitution should emphasize that wherever possible, the system should make an effort to make the all persuasion, political persuasion, as publicly available as possible, so that we can all know and that who is persuading whom. And and now that we have the technology, obviously, you know, back in the 1700s or 1800s, a lot of this would not be possible. But now that we have this technology, we can enable a system where everyone can post petitions and or comments online and have those petitions or comments be visible to everyone else. And to do that, we can have a system where everyone who has the ability to vote can have some sort of system ID, like a login password, you know, username password system. And so every registered voter should have that access, and it should be like a well-guarded secret. And every user, every registered voter in this system will have some sort of public handle so that they can hide their identity. So in other words, if I want to persuade a certain politician, a certain legislator about a certain issue, I will log in with my very private username and password, go in, post a comment, and have that comment or petition be publicly available for everyone else to see. So anyone else can log in and do a search or somehow find my petition. But obviously, just to protect the right to privacy, we should then just show the handle, some sort of public handle to identify the person, so it can be something completely different from your name. But we can know that Tiger37 said something about a certain bill to a certain politician, and it would be publicly available. And again, we should make every effort to prevent group persuasion unless it is done in a unanimous way. In other words, all persuasion should be as individual as possible. A company should not be able to persuade or try to persuade a politician to vote a certain way unless every single person in the company can be known for sure that they agree with that persuasion. And because that in practical life will never happen, then it should not really be allowed. If there's a political action group that comes together and says we're, for example, a pro-life group or something, they can come together and then try to persuade their politician. But I sincerely believe that it would not be a good idea to have the political action group do the persuasion and have some way of telling a politician to vote a certain way. That they should organize to promote ideas to persuade the public but they should not be allowed to persuade the legislators, if that makes any sense, not directly at least. They should be able to rally people and get the message out, you know, their message, whether it be a good or bad message, they should have the right to get the message out to the people, to the voters. But they should not be allowed to then, as a group, go and try to persuade a politician, a legislator, to vote a certain way. Every persuasion should be individual. So it should have these qualities. It should be individual. It should not be a professional persuasion. No proxy, no persuasion by proxy, where you are getting paid, especially you're getting paid to go persuade. And third, it should be as publicly available as possible. So these three qualities of persuasion should be embedded in the Constitution. And for sure, it should be very clear in the Constitution, professional lobbying is unconstitutional and is subject to financial and or criminal penalties. And that should end that whole system. Imagine the horror that would break out throughout Washington if it was ever announced that lobbying is gone. The current politicians under the current political system would just pull their hairs in horror and walk around in total dismay if they ever had that system dismantled. But it has to be dismantled from the Constitution. And I really don't know exactly when lobbying became a big thing in America, but I would not be surprised if it happened from the very beginning, and that the founding fathers were, in a sense, exposed to it and allowed it in a way to happen. But it wasn't clearly as bad then as it is now. I could say with some hesitation that the cancer must have been visible even then, and they did nothing about it because, again, they were never thinking about things at a deeper metaphysical foundational level. They were just trying to get things going, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it type of mindset, and that's how we ended up with this current mess. So professional lobbying would be gone, and we have described how persuasion, political persuasion, should be carried out, and that should be clearly laid out in the Constitution. And the other minor detail we wanted to mention, a second minor detail, would be that the Constitution should require a national ID for all voting. And that has been a controversial issue in the U.S. From two standpoints. The concept of having an ID to vote is, quote, revolting to Democrats, in the U.S., but it's mostly because they know that if there's some sort of ID, it will prevent the corruption that they have depended on for so many decades. And they always claim that an ID system for voting is some sort of poll tax. And they try to equate it with the horrible stuff that happened in the South during and after Reconstruction, at the end of the Civil War, where people in the South started passing laws to make it very difficult for Black people to vote. And one of their runarounds the new freedom of Black people in the Constitution was to impose these poll taxes, where people were forced to pay a certain amount in order to vote. And they would set it at such a level that Black people who were new in the economic system as free people would not have the power to pay these taxes and then be able to vote. So it was a subtle way of suppressing the vote. and Democrats constantly point back to that. And ironically, it was Democrats who were imposing poll taxes in the South. It was the Democrat Party that was imposing all this racism. So it's ironic that the Democrat Party is now pointing to that sort of corrupt behavior and trying to equate an ID requirement to that. And the answer to that, I've always said, I don't know why Republicans don't just say it out loud. Okay, if you really think that imposing an ID is some sort of poll tax because that means that you have to pay to get an ID, then let's make it, let's pass some law that makes it free. If you can't pay for it, we will pay it for you, or we will loan you the money so that you can pay it and you can eventually pay it off at the next tax return or whatever. But we can make it so that everyone can have an ID. And if it's such an issue, why not just make it free for all? I don't agree with that idea, but the point is that it's a very easy excuse to overcome. And in fact, getting an ID is not really that expensive. And you would think by the arguments Democrats make that no poor people, especially no black person, drives a car because they are so poor that they can't even get a driver's license. But that's not the reality. Everyone has an ID. You need an ID. You need some sort of identification or something to function in society in general. And only a very, very, very limited group of people do not have IDs. And poor people have an IDs. Poor people have mobile phones and cars and light driving licenses and so forth. So the concept that an ID is too expensive for the poor people to acquire is ridiculous. And you go to third world countries. In third world countries, they require ID for voting. It's a normal thing around the world, around the third world, around poverty-stricken nations. No one goes around saying, oh, that's a poll tax. That is just a figment of the American liberal imagination. Even in third world countries that are way, way poorer than America, if you show up to the polls to vote, you have to show some ID, and it's usually a national level ID. So if they can do it, why can't we? And Democrats who are so generous with other people's money, why don't they just say, okay, let's provide financial support for the poor people who can't pay the $40, $50 that are required to get an ID and function in society. There is no justification for that. So Democrats have been complaining about the concept of an ID for voting because the moment you enable that or enforce an ID, then illegal aliens can't vote anymore. Then it's easier for voter fraud to happen, for people to vote in the name of dead people, and it just becomes a nightmare. And I understand that the founding fathers didn't worry about that because things were more informal back in the day, and also there was a higher level of honesty back in the day, but now that we have continued as a nation for decades and decades, it has become very clear we need an ID, and it is just ridiculous that we are in the first quarter of the 21st century, and we still don't have an ID requirement system to vote. And it is ridiculous. And so Democrats are opposed to the concept of an ID. And Republicans, especially diehard conservatives, are opposed to the concept of a national ID because to them, oh, that's the federal government controlling our lives and we don't want them to identify us. For crying out loud, we already all, you know, in America, everyone already has a social security number. It's a form of federal ID that we all have. And that social security number is required for so many things, including getting a credit card and loans and all these things that we usually, you know, when you apply for a job, you have to provide your social security number and so forth. And to pay taxes, you have to provide the social security number or an ITIN if you're not a citizen. So the system is already in place. What are, when conservatives complain about a national ID and say that's empowering the government, what are they talking about? It is ridiculous. We have this very disorganized, decentralized system with multiple IDs everywhere, already at the federal level and the state level. And it's all disconnected. There's a total disconnect. And that's why we have an identity theft problem in America, because everything is so informal and so disconnected and so decentralized. We wouldn't have that sort of problem if we had a national ID system, very clear, very open. You don't have to have a social security number and then another form of identification and all this to kind of combine your identity. It is ridiculous. This concept of federalism has, like a cancer, divided us, divided the whole system in so many fundamental ways, including even the way that crime enforcement operated. That's why you'd have the FBI doing their thing and local police doing their thing and everybody doing their thing and not sharing information. That's why terrorism became a problem, because different agencies, different law enforcement groups had different had their own set of information. They would not share it with others, and that would make it easier for terrorists to operate. So this whole cancer of divided information, because we are so concerned about a tyrannical central government, it is nonsense. It's just ridiculous. And we already have the tyranny. Look at what we have right now at the time of this recording. Tyranny abounding. And we still, and it's not because of a national ID. We don't have a national ID, and we still have tyranny. We have tyranny at the state level. We have tyranny at the federal level. We have tyranny at every level. The tyranny is not because some sort of national ID. That's not the source of it. The tyranny is because of fundamental structural issues. And we don't deal with the fundamental issues, and we cling to these ridiculous notions. And conservatives are idiots. And every time they oppose a national ID, they're showing their stupidity. And they're not complete disconnect with reality, because they're so in love with their ideology and their founding father worship and all that. So the new American Constitution will definitely require a national ID system. And people should stop complaining about that, especially in the conservative side. We should have a very clear centralized system so that we can control how things are operating at the national level, instead of having this disjointed system where people then can disguise themselves as other people. So we were talking a moment ago about the problem of identity theft for financial reasons in America. But there's a problem of identity theft at the voting level as well. And it's because we don't have a clear-cut national ID. But we tolerate it for tax purposes. We have a very clear centralized ID system for tax purposes. And that's okay with us. We've been okay with that. But not for for everything else. Why should we have a social security number and a tax ID identity that is separate from the ID to vote? why? Why do we have this crazy fragmented system? It should be very straightforward. You're born into this country, you get an ID, a national ID, that's it. And that's your identity, and it should be very clear, associated to a picture, and we can verify that's you, and yes, that's you voting, that's you getting a loan, that's you this and that, and we shouldn't have this disjointed a system that is supposedly protecting people's privacy, protecting people from tyranny, but it's not doing that. In fact, it has enabled tyranny because it has enabled fraud. So that's point number one. We said was professional lobbying and constitutional. Point number two, all voting should require a national ID. And additional point number three would be that the Constitution should require all voting to be in person with very strict exceptions. And that would that is required because of the what happened in 2020 and the stolen election of 2020. Where the current hypochondriac environment was an excuse that enabled the Democrats to stuff the ballots with false votes, and so we should require voting in person, which was more or less a de facto rule up until now. But now that the system has been abused, we have to be very clear about it from the constitutional level that it should be in person, but with very strict exceptions. Obviously, one exception would be the exception that has been accepted for decades, and reasonably so, is military members who are abroad. If you have service members who are serving the country, sacrificing their lives literally, for the country, they should have every right to vote, and there's no problem with them voting, because that can be easily monitored against fraud. Naturally, because the army or the military is usually very well disciplined and controlled, and so that should not be an issue. So it'd be very difficult for someone to fake being a dead soldier and voting, because that is not not as easily done as a regular civilian trying to vote on behalf of a dead person. And sadly, even that was in a sense abused in the 2020 elections. The military absentee voting was totally distorted by Democrats, but it's because of the voting system we have, the federal voting system, which we have described it at length, how federalism enabled voter fraud and allowed local state legislatures to institute systems that suppressed voting. So these military members who mostly voted Republican and have traditionally voted Republican most of the time, their vote was suppressed and a lot of their voting was virtually eliminated by the Democrats. But they should be allowed to do absentee balloting in a very very transparent way. And we should ensure mechanisms that that protect that vote. That vote is sacrosanct. Everyone's vote is sacrosanct. But if you think about a person who is fighting for the country, serving the country from abroad, and being deployed abroad, sent abroad by the country should say, "Hey, we sent you there. We should make sure you still have the right to vote and influence the system that is sending you to that country." That should be in the Constitution that anyone who tampers with that voting should get a minimum prison sentence of 2.5 years and pay at least $25,000 in fine or something very, very drastic, something like 40% of your national the national average, household average, that should be the minimum you have to pay as a penalty if you are ever caught in voter fraud, especially if you're distorting the voting, absentee voting of military members. And another exception, obviously, could be would be citizens who are traveling or temporarily living abroad, and citizens who are incapable of travel due to health reasons. You know, someone who cannot show him or herself in person at a voting place, and but those exceptions should be very tightly monitored. I can't think exactly off the top of my head how that can be done, but I think that if we have a national a system that is going to be very, very secure, very tightly protected, where you every voter has their login name and password, that system can enable absentee voting somehow. And it should have some sort of verifiable way of showing proof of life, where maybe the person can take a picture of themselves, a recent picture, and I don't know, maybe you know, the old trick that people used to do to prove that they were alive. For example, if someone was kidnapped, and the people paying the ransom wanted proof of life, they would ask for some photo with today's newspaper. But I don't know if that's really that feasible nowadays, because we don't use newspapers, printed newspapers anymore. But there must be some sort of way that people can prove, take a picture of themselves, maybe with a screenshot, next to a screenshot of a recent website, a news website headline. So instead of a printed newspaper, they could maybe hold up their computer screen with a website with news of the day to prove that they are alive. And so there should be some sort of very strict mechanism that we can impose from the internet standpoint. When it comes to mail, voting by mail, I'm not sure exactly how that can be done. But when the new constitution is written, people should try to find a mechanism that should be embedded in the constitution to ensure that these other exceptions, the civilian exceptions, are very clearly protected from fraud. And we should make sure that people who vote in absentia that are very old can be proved to be alive, because that is a big problem, especially in Democrat, heavily Democrat districts and regions, where people who are 120 years old are voting again and again and again, year after year, and no one takes them off the voting rolls. So if someone dies, that's the problem with having this fragmented identity system that we have in America. If someone dies and everybody knows they died, and their relatives know they died, they went and buried the son of a gun, they buried him 6 feet under, and obviously the IRS knows that they're dead, because otherwise they'd be going after them for not filing their tax returns, and yet they can still vote because there is no centralized system. If someone knows, if someone dies and certain agencies already know that this person is dead, then everybody in the system should know that they're dead and they shouldn't be allowed to vote. So how can the IRS not be going after these people who are not paying their taxes, 120-year-old people who are not filing taxes, but yet at the same time we allow them to vote? How can that happen? That is so stupid. But if we have something embedded in the Constitution that requires this national ID system, that requires monitoring of old people in some way, then will be okay. Now, if a 120-year-old person shows up to vote at the voting place, then that's proof of life right there. They can show their ID, they're so-and-so, and you look at them and you go, yeah, he's 120 years old, definitely. Go ahead, vote, then problem solved. But the issue is with the absentee voting. And that should be taken care of in the Constitution. The internet system would be a way to control that, but you also have to take into account that you cannot impose the internet on people. Some people just are not internet savvy or don't want to be internet savvy, and they should be able to vote, still be allowed to vote. But we have to find a mechanism that where we can control that without forcing them to be on the internet. And obviously, if a person is in such bad health that they can't go through the process to verify their voting, the validity of their voting, then they shouldn't vote. For example, if someone's in a coma, they clearly don't have the presence of mind to know who to vote for, and they shouldn't be allowed to vote. Obviously, if someone is in dementia and doesn't know left from right, then we shouldn't be worrying about giving them the right to vote. Well, they can vote if they want to. If they're all crazy and get on a bus and go to the voting place and vote for Bugs Bunny for president, that's their thing. But we shouldn't be worrying about giving these people the right to vote in absentia, or how to ensure that they can vote. If you're crazy, demented, you're very, very sick, and you're fighting for your life, you're not thinking about who to vote for, then let's not worry about how to make it as easy as possible for them to vote in absentia. So I hope I'm making sense with what I'm trying to say, that we should focus on voting in person, and then make it put very strict limits on how to vote in absentia, and not be so concerned about letting everybody vote if they can't show up to the voting place. We should have the mechanism, but it should be a very controlled mechanism, and candidates should be able to contest absentia voting. There should be a system to contest in absentia voting, so that if any corruption happens, we can rectify it. And that takes us to our fourth point, comment, is that the Constitution should have a clear mechanism for verifying elections and decertifying them if they show great irregularities. And the Founding Fathers didn't think of that, yet these men who knew about the corruption of the human nature, as conservatives always say with such pride, these men who knew how evil man can be, never thought about the possibility of voter fraud, which is just ridiculous. And they just said every state can decide how they do their voting. They put that in the Constitution. Every state can define their own laws on how to vote. So they basically gave a carte blanche to every state. You know, do whatever you want. If you want to suppress vote, if you don't want women, one-legged men over the age of 35 to vote, that's your thing. You can pass a law like that. Just do whatever you want. You know, how stupid can you get? That's what the Founding Fathers did. So they enabled all this mechanism where people could commit fraud and suppress voting rights at the state level. And the federal government had no power to change that. And that's why when the Civil War ended and the South was stubborn idiots stupidly continuing to suppress black vote because they were determined not to give black people freedom, even after they had lost. And this is all Lincoln's fault. We've talked about that before. Then we were forced to pass the 13th, I mean, sorry, the 14th and 15th Amendments to try to give the federal government more power over how states can run their voting. But even as we did all that, we never worried about having a mechanism to contest an election. And there was one of the amendments, either the 14th or 15th, had this thing where if it was found that a state was suppressing the voting of a certain group, then they would lose representation proportional to that, to the amount of voter suppression. So if they suppressed 10% of the vote, then they lose 10% of representation in Congress, which, as we explained before, is like saying if you're caught stealing $1,000, you'll have to give the $1,000 back. So that means that if you steal it and get away with it, then you're good. But if you get caught, you just have to give it back. So at the end of the day, you didn't lose anything. That's how stupid we have been. So that was the closest we have ever come to a mechanism to deal with voter fraud. But we should have we should have thought about this. We're in the middle. We're inside deep into the 21st century, and we still don't have a national mechanism to deal with voter fraud. That's why when 2020 happened, all the Supreme Court justices, raised their hands in the air as if they just didn't care, and all the state legislators, because they control voting. Even the RINOs and everybody else were just raised their hands and said, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, there's no mechanism here to deal with any sort of irregularity. There really is nothing we can do. And that's how the fraud just was left to happen. So the Constitution should have a clear mechanism for verifying elections and decertifying them if they show intense irregularities. And there should be a mechanism of auditing, and if ballots, if a certain percentage, let's say, 5% of the vote of the voting was shown to have irregularities, the election should be repeated, whether it be a presidential election or the election of a judge or the election of the mayor of a certain town, whatever it is, the Constitution should say, hey, you have to repeat it. Because we are seeing that irregularities are happening, and I don't know the exact details that we can put into the Constitution right off the bat to ensure that, but someone should think about it and plaster it, or at least on principle put that concept clause in the Constitution that an election can be constitutionally decertified if it can be proved to have had many irregularities. So now let's try to quickly mention some final comments that we wanted to share about the ranked voting system that we were talking about in the previous audio snippet. As you may recall, we spoke of this ranked voting system where a person can be allowed to vote, let's say, for up to 5 candidates in whatever election it may be. They can write in 5 people, and every candidate will have an ID. Well, it's going to be very, very organic. Anyone can submit their candidacy, and they will get an ID, and they just have to promote their ID to those who will vote for them, so that when they go to vote, they know this is the ID for such and such person. So they can put in up to 5. And so it's not voting for just one person, it's voting for up to 5 candidates. Choice number 1, choice number 2, all the way down to choice number 5. Choice number 1 gets 5 points, choice number 2 gets 4 points, choice number 3 gets 3, choice number 4 gets 2, and choice number 5 gets 1. So, and if you only want to vote for one person, you just put in that person at the top. And if you only want to vote for 3 people, because that they're the only people you think are good enough for the job. You just vote A, B, and C, and only those people would get points from your ballot. So that is this ranked voting system, and whoever gets the most points, combined points from all the voting, wins the election. And I think it's important to show an example or try to explain how that system will end the reign of the half-hearted rhinos in the American political system. We have had the system where we've always had to choose between the lesser of two evils because the system promotes the rise of half-hearted people and evil people. And then when they, and it's always just two options, and we're forced to vote between the two options. And the two options have arisen because we have two major political parties. So the party system will be gone. So now there's a plurality, a more democratic system. And just like in recall elections in California, for example, anyone can submit their votes, their candidacy, and then be voted on by people. And but let's think of the voting system, a ranked voting system, and how it helps to end this system where you always have the rise of an evil person and a half evil person, and you always have to choose between the lesser of those two evils. So let's consider an example. Let's say there's a small town, just to make the numbers very round and very easy to manage. It's a town of 100 people, 100 voters, and they are voting for the mayor or something, and there are three potential candidates. So there's a candidate called, let's call him Rhinola. And this Rhinola fellow is a rhino, a Republican in name only, you know, a person who claims to be a conservative or stand for Republican values, but at the end ends up voting for a lot of the time with Democrats. Rhinos, you know, as they're called in America, Republicans in name only, R-I-N-O. So let's say that we have a Rhinola as a candidate. And then we also have another candidate whose name we'll call Liberola. And Liberola is a diehard vegetarian, tree-hugging liberal who wants free abortion for everyone and believes white people are racist, even though he himself is a racist, a white person. And a racist. If you're a Democrat, you're a racist by default. But let's not get into that. So the thing is that this is the second option, the Liberola, a very diehard left-wing liberal nut job. And then there is a third candidate that we'll call, his last name will be Tipartini. And he's more of a Tea Party type candidate. And as you may recall, back in 10 to 15 years ago from the time of this recording, there was the rise of this movement, the Tea Party movement, of people who wanted a deeper change. And most of them were deeply conservative, but they were more of the activist conservative, which is a bit of an oxymoron, because conservatism tends towards stagnation. And that's why it's been so difficult for conservatives to be more activists, because their religion, their conservatism, prevents them doing that. And that's why the Democrats have gained the upper hand, because they are activists by nature. So that's why they indoctrinate people and they do all this maneuvering, while conservatives just conserve their position. But back in the 2009, 2010, you had the Tea Party movement and people rising up with more conviction and the willingness to fight the system. And that lasted for a short while. Unfortunately, they kind of tapered off for reasons that go outside the scope of this audio snippet. But let's say they have you have this person who is, let's say, still a conservative. So we would be opposed, let's say, to a lot of the ideas that such a person would share, you know, the worship of the founding fathers and all that. But let's say that he more or less is a decent person with principles and will do some decent work if he gets elected. So we have these three candidates, Rainola, Liberola, and Tipartini, in this town of 100 voters. And let's say that the town is kind of divided in three groups that more or less coincide with these voter, these candidates. Let's say that 40% or 40 of the townspeople are nut-wing liberals, people who will only vote liberal Democrat and hate Republicans. And to them, Republicans are the, are Satan personified. So they will would rather die than vote for a Republican or someone who is not an, a nut job liberal. So that's 40% of the town. And then there are 35 people or 35% in this town that, or let's say 25% who are more or less mildly conservative. So they're moderate. So they're half in, half out. They kind of agree with some liberal ideas, but they also agree with some conservative ideas. So they're half-baked, and that's 25% of the population. And then there's the rest, the other 35 are a little more conservative and leaning towards Tea Party ideas and so forth. So these are the three groups. So you, as you can see in that scenario, the majority, the largest group is the liberals, 40 of them, and then 35 Tea Party people and 25 wishy-washy moderates. So that's the makeup. And what happens usually, in because we have a two-party system and a system that promotes two options, because when you only vote for one person, you're basically you're doing a binary thing in a sense. In an implicit way, voting for just one person is promoting a system where you will only have two candidates. I know that doesn't sound right right off the bat, but if you think about it, there is a certain logic to that. Whenever you can just vote for one person, you're choosing one person over others, and usually it's over another person, one other person. So we have the system that promotes two candidates, and two-party system. And usually what, you know, the in this example, the liberals don't have to think about it. They know who they're going to vote for. They're going to vote for Liberola, and that's that. So they are set. But then the other two groups, the moderates and the more Tea Party-ish people, have to think about it a little more because they have two options. They have the Mr. Rainola, and they have Tipartini. And what happens usually is they start thinking amongst themselves, if we just vote for the person we like the most, then Liberola is going to win because Liberola has 40 votes for sure. And Tipartini has 35 supporters and Rainola has 25. So if everyone just votes for their one choice, then the Liberola guy is going to win, even though in reality, the town is more conservative than liberal, even though the conservatives are the larger group. Which sounds weird, but there are three groups. That's why that can happen. So what the other two groups tend to do is that they kind of make a choice, like Sophie's choice. And they go, okay, you know, we have to consolidate our voting and just vote for one of these two, you know, Rainola or Tipartini. So they kind of, even though they might not like a certain person, they just kind of put their finger, what finger in the air and decide, okay, which of the two has a likelier chance of winning? So I'll just vote for him. And usually what happens is people tend to vote for the Rainolas of the world because the Tipartinis, they are radical. They are a little more radical in the sense that they are activists and they are fighting for a principle. They're fighting for an idea, so they create controversy. Rainola doesn't create controversy. He is a wishy-washy Republican who kind of likes to please both sides of the aisle as much as possible and get away with as much lukewarmness as he can. So so he doesn't stir, or he doesn't rock the boat. Tea Partini is saying things that are outraging the 40 nutjob liberals in the town. So when you look at it from your individual perspective, you people tend to go, okay, yeah, Tea Partini is, I don't think he's going to win because he just says things that anger people. And so, you know what, I think I'll vote for Rainola. Even though I like Tea Partini, I think I'll have to vote for Rainola. So then people tend to gravitate towards Rainola and vote for him. And obviously also, because we have a two-party system, usually Rainola and Tea Partini are fighting for the Republican nomination. And that's where the choice is made, where people say, who has the better chance of beating Liberola? They might like Tea Partini more, but they're afraid that Tea Partini is not going to be strong enough to beat Liberola, so they just go for the safe option for Rainola, and Rainola ends up winning. And then you have Rainola against Liberola, and then you have the, you know, the fight, having to choose between half evil and full blown evil, and that's why things never change. So if you have a no party system, and you have these three candidates up for vote, and you have a choice of up to five candidates in each ballot, then people can do the following. They will, what they will do is say, okay, I don't have to choose and try to play it safe and gamble on Rainola. What I can do is, if I like Tea Partini, but I'm afraid that Tea Partini might not win, then what I'll do is I'll vote for Tea Partini number one and Rainola number two in my ballot. So Tea Partini will get five votes for my ballot and four, and Rainola will get four. Or maybe I dislike Rainola, so what I can do, and this should be allowed, is I can leave slot number two empty and put him in slot number three to give him three votes, 3 points. So Tea Partini will get my 5 points from the top slot, and Rainola will get 3 points from my ballot because I didn't place him number two, I placed him number three, or I can even place him lower. But I can vote for two people, at least, for two or up to five in this case, people. And that way I can, like, in a sense, play it safe, if you can call it that, where I can vote for my candidate of choice and then have a backup in case my first choice doesn't make it or is not popular enough. So I didn't sacrifice my vote. I didn't throw away my vote, because that's what people say. Oh, you're throwing away your vote if you vote for Tea Partini. And you know, Tea Partini might have more support than people think. But because he's so controversial, people don't realize that he has more support than Rainola. So they just vote for Rainola because he sounds safer. And you have the media also vilifying Tea Partini. So Tea Partini might have more votes, but people become afraid and think that Rainola is more popular than he really is. So they just vote for him. And Tea Partini gets sacrificed. But if you have this voting system, ranked voting system, then you can play it safe. You can be safe and vote for Tea Partini number one and Rainola number two or further down. And same with the other way around. If you like Rainola a little more than Tea Partini because Tea Partini says some controversial things you don't like, then go ahead, vote for Rainola. Put him number one. And then, but you don't like Liberola at all. So just to play it safe, you can put Tea Partini as number two in your ballot. And so that would mean that, so if they vote along those lines in that town, 25 of the people are going to, they're the wishy-washy ones. So they're going to vote for Rainola number one and Tea Partini number two. Let's say one and two, just to make it simple. So 25 people are going to vote Rainola 5 points, Tea Partini 4 points. And then the more committed Tea Party people, 35 in that town, they will vote Tea Partini number one, 5 points, and Rainola number two, let's say, 4 points. And then you have the 40 nutjob liberal voters. They will vote just for Liberola, number one, and they won't even put a vote for the other two because they disdain them so much, because you know, liberals are so radical and nut job about their thinking, and they will not even put Rainola or Tipartini in their ballot. So it's just all 5 points for Liberola. So there you go. So now you have the ballots like that. So if you add it up, 25 ballots have Rainola with 5 points and Tipartini with four. 35 ballots have Tipartini with five and Rainola with four. And 40 ballots have Liberola with 5 points. And if you do the numbers, that means that Rainola will get 125 points from the Wishiwashi group and 140 points from the Tea Party group. And that gives him 265 points. Liberola will get 40 votes from the Nutjob Liberals, 40 times 5, 200 points. And Tea Partini will get 100 points from the Wishiwashi people, 25 times 4, and 175 points from the Tea Party voters, 35 times 5, that's 175. So that gives him a total of 275 votes. So the final results will be Tea Partini with 275, Rainola with 265, and Liberola with 200. And as you can see, that's a more clear reflection of the reality that's out there. That overall, Tea Partini has a wider support in that town, and he's going to get the majority of points and win. So there's no Sophie's Choice situation where you have to choose between between Rainola and Tea Partini to save yourself from the crazy nut job Liberola. You can vote your conscience and be sure that you're not just throwing your vote away when you vote for a certain candidate, because you can have a backup in your ballot because you can vote for more than one person. And that clearly will end the this controversy that we always have to go through of choosing between death by lethal injection and death by a thousand cuts. So I hope this example kind of makes sense. And it's also important to that's one final thing. And a second final thing we wanted to say or emphasize is that the ranked voting system will help to end the binary, simplistic two-party system that we have without the chaos of a multi-party system. Because in many countries, if you travel and go to other countries, you will find that in many places around the world, you have all these parties, the Green Party, the Social Democrats, traffic supporting Tea Party system. So you have all these parties with all these strange names, and people are forced to choose between like 10 or 15 different options. And what happens in those countries usually is that, let's say when they vote for president, they have to, because the vote is so split up, then what they do is do a runoff. So the top two vote getters go on a runoff to decide who wins the election. And it gets a very messy, very complicated. And again, because people only vote for one person, they have to kind of live or die with just one option. And you get the fragmentation of voting, and it's a disaster. Like, for example, in this example we just gave of a town where 40% are liberals, 35% are Tea Party, 25% are wishy-washy. If you do it with a one vote, one candidate per vote system, what you'd have is Liberola gets 40, Tea Party gets 35, Tea Partini gets 35, and Rainola gets 25. So Rainola would drop out, and then in the runoff, you'd have Liberola against Tea Partini. And maybe in that case, Tea Partini might or might not win, who knows. But you have to go through all this runoff process. It gets much more convoluted. the ranked voting system kind of ends that controversy. And also, what happens is when it comes to legislators, in the legislature, if you have a multi-party system, you have, you know, 15 from the Green Party, 17 from the Yellow Party, and 25 from the Blue Party, and then you have this very fractured legislature and parliament, for example, and then what they do is they start forming coalitions so that they can form a majority government and elect a prime minister and so forth. So you have all this political wrangling back and forth where the political parties have the power to negotiate. So the people are out of the picture by then, and these political parties can do their wrangling and their coalescing and all that. And it gets very political and very messy and very corrupt very quickly. So the ranked voter system will get rid of all of that. And again, combined with everything we said before, we're going to have a system where the focus is the individual. You don't need to have a coalition government of these parties uniting to work together and have a working government, because every legislator is an individual. He's not a member of a party. When he is elected and voting in the legislature, he is his or her own person. He or she is his or her own person, and they vote their conscience, and everything just develops organically. So the ranked voting system combined with everything we explained before will allow us to end the two-party system without the chaos of a multi-party system. And the third and final thing we wanted to mention or emphasize is that all presidential elections under the new American Constitution will be national. So we're going to have the end of the electoral college system that we have in America, where when it comes to president, the state, you win the entire state. So if you win the state by one vote, then you get all the electoral votes or the points, you could say, from that state. And federalism forces this system where absolutely all elections that we have are at the state level at the most. Everything we vote for is at the state level at the most. So if I want to vote for a Republican and I'm in a deep blue Democrat state, I'm basically just throwing my vote away, because there's no chance in hell that my vote's going to count in any way, because it's going to be drowned in this sea of blue. And so it discourages voting. And it also promotes sectarianism, because Republicans don't campaign in California for president because they have convinced themselves that California is lost, and it makes no sense to invest money in California if California is going to vote for a Democrat anyway. But if you have a system where everything is national, then even if you're going to lose California, you want as many votes as possible. So it doesn't matter if you get them from a person in California or a person in Georgia or Minnesota or Virginia, you're still going to get the vote, and it's going to count the same, instead of getting drowned out by the majority in that state. So it's going to promote more variety across the country and end the sectarianism that we have. So the Federalist Electoral College system suppresses the vote of the individual because it gives the state a wider voter importance. And it also promotes local fraud, because the local party machinery, as we've described before, and usually the Democrat Party, can pass laws that enable local fraud. They can choose, what voting machines they want to implement at the state level, and what monitoring system is going to be in place. They define everything. So the local controlling party, if it's mostly Democrat, they can decide the laws that will favor their favor them and allow them to cover up their fraud more easily and make them less accountable if fraud is detected later. And so it hides fraud from the national spotlight and prevents accountability. So part of the castration of the political party system is making sure that all elections, all presidential elections are national, and it requires the end of the electoral college system. So that's all we had to say, and we've run way long, and I believe we'll move on to a different topic in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.